You're listening to the 10 Bagger Podcast, presented by The Daily Gold. Join us as we uncover tomorrow's 10 baggers today. And now here's your host, Jordan Royburn.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the 10 Bagger Podcast. Today, we have episode number 12, and with me is at least a new guest as far as my audience, but I'm sure some of you know who he is. His name is Brian Lenny. He is the editor and publisher of Junior Stock Review. You can find that at juniorstockreview.com. So, Brian, as we get started, why don't you tell us about your background and what you do at Junior Stock Review?
Sure. So I'm an engineer by trade. I hold a professional designation in Ontario, Canada. Originally out of school, I started working in the steel manufacturing business, working first as a process engineer on the floor. And then towards the end, I got into management. Ever since I started working, I've been investing my money and specifically in the junior resource sector. You know, I was immediately attracted to the, you know, kind of huge gains that you could make. And, you know, from there, I started investing. I took a big step in 2013. I sold my house and I used 2/3 of the equity to invest in what I thought were the best juniors over the course of 2014 and 2015. And in 2016, I was repaid for my courage and I guess my good picks. And my portfolio went up around 300%. And with a very understanding wife, I decided to leave my career in steel manufacturing to pursue investing full time. And so for the last 4 years, I've been writing a free newsletter on juniorstockreview.com, basically, you know, writing about what I invest in the market.
Awesome. And just one follow up on that. So your background as an engineer, how does that inform your research and some of the companies that you invest in, if it doesn't form it at all?
Sure. Well, you know, there's definitely from a metallurgical standpoint, I've got, you know, a good understanding of metallurgy. It doesn't necessarily make me an expert in, you know, the mineral processing and stuff within the mining industry, but I'm able to learn it. And I think that's the biggest takeaway for me is that I've become a professional learner over my life, and I'm able to use those analytical abilities to, you know, form opinions that have definitely worked out for me. So I say that's the biggest advantage in terms of my education translating into the investment world.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the success that you've had and some of the things that you've invested in. What kinds of companies do you look at? Are you straight just looking at all exploration companies, or do you invest in junior producers or royalty companies? I mean, what have you invested in, and what are you looking for exactly?
Sure. So first, I'm agnostic to the metal. I think the premise around, you know, all of my investing is I invest in companies where I see profit or the potential of profit. But really my investing is anchored, in value. So that's recognizing the intrinsic value of a company and comparing that, to their market cap or essentially what they're selling for and, you know, finding that opportunity, in the two. And, you know, that can be exploration companies, that can be developers, that can be producers. You know, there really isn't a sweet spot, so to speak. It's just wherever I find that value. And that's what's done me well over the course of time.
Okay, so you cashed in really big on the huge rebound the sector had in 2016. Can you share a couple names that you invested in that did really well for you?
Absolutely. So the largest gain that I got and to date is still the largest was Ivanhoe. I'm not sure on the exact, you know, I think that was a 10 bagger or in and around there. I bought it around 60 or 70 cents and was able to sell it basically at the high, maybe just a little bit below, which, you know, that's more by chance than anything, and was selling along the way. Another one, Reservoir Minerals, was a big win for me. And Gold Standard Ventures. Those are probably my three biggest, you know, wins over the last, let's say, 5 to 6 years, and have really set up where I am now.
Okay, so where you are now that you have a lot more capital, as you said. Has that changed what you're looking for? Are you looking for, I mean, will you look at even larger companies as far as value, or are you still, I guess, looking for the same thing that you were looking for when you started out?
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's, yeah, like I said, it's still value that pushes me forward in terms of my investment thesis. And really, it's the differential between price and value. I'm still anchored in that. You know, I've tended to still stay with the smaller companies. And as of late, it's been ones that have basically a PEA. You know, given the market that we're in, I think there's a real sweet spot there when you can look for, you know, brownfield exploration on projects that have already been established in some way, but aren't being recognized. You know, it's vitally important that you understand why the market has sort of written off or not recognized the value of that company. And then conversely, how that company is got, you know, actions moving forward, how they're going to dig themselves out of that hole. And once you have a grasp on those both sides of the coin and the price to value ratio is there, that's when, you know, I decide to make an investment. And it's worked out really well for me over the last, especially the last, you know, 2 years where, you know, things have come together. And that's in the heart of like one of the worst bear markets in history. So I tend to think that kind of mentality or process is a good way to keep going in the future. And one thing I'll just add to that is I try to remain, you know, constant in my process, regardless of where the market is headed. I don't try to guess, you know, gold is going up and therefore I focus on gold. I do truly try to look at the company itself and recognize the value and what they have moving forward to get that value recognized.
So yeah, I'm very interested on, so you invest in some companies that already have a PEA. So, I mean, after that point, what are some of the things that you look for exactly? Do you look for something that still has, I mean, you mentioned brownfield exploration. Do you look for things that still have significant exploration potential and they can really enhance the numbers in the PEA? Or do you look at something that you just feel, you know, the market's ignoring the PEA, this is really undervalued? Just take us a little bit deeper in your process.
Sure. Sure. You know what? I'll use an example. The last write-up that I did in December was on a company called Fireweed Zinc. And the zinc market, for one, was a huge learning experience for me. And it really confirmed that, you know, for me, there's no point in trying to guess where a metal is headed in terms of its price, given how complex the metals markets are. So, you know, after that point, I wanted to look at the fundamentals and again, you know, understand why a company is where it's at and how it's going to move forward. So with Fireweed Zinc, you know, it had a great run out of its IPO and it came back. You know, that zinc price fell, I think it was the beginning of 2018, and really just crushed the market. And over the course of 2019, we've really seen the zinc companies really get hit hard. But for me, what I was looking at was like, you know what, I recognize that they've been hit and I want to buy stuff that's on sale. But you need to have kind of an idea of how that company is going to dig themselves out. So let's say with Fireweed Zinc. Now, they do require, I think it's $1.24 is their PEA zinc price that they used. And it is like, even though they have zinc, lead and silver, zinc is what pushes that deposits economics. So you need something that not only is going to, you know, be positive in terms of the economics, but something that, you know, that is different than everybody else. And in Fireweed's case, they've got a large silver component, which I think, given, you know, the outlook for precious metals, kind of where we are, the global economy, things look pretty good. And with that large silver component, I think that's something that could add value and potentially lower the, you know, metal prices that are required to make that thing economic. Second to that, you know, Fireweed's deposit kind of sticks out in my opinion because of its size. And the grade is pretty good too. But the size, this, you know, large SEDEX deposit, you just don't find stuff that's, you know, 50 million tons plus. There's tons of small things, you know, 10 to 15 million tons with pretty good grade. But again, Fireweed's Tom and Jason deposits stand out because of their size. And then thirdly, what I think is most important to the whole investment thesis for fireweed is the discovery they made, or rediscovery they made, on the boundary zone. You know, this is a periphery deposit outside of Tom and Jason, where there was some exploration, but Brandon, the CEO, and his exploration team decided to drop a couple holes, and they picked right. They got some long, thick intervals of high grade zinc, and really what this does is improves the economic, or I think potentially improves the economics of the whole project. This boundary zone, if it were to be in production, would be in production in the first few years of the mine. And therefore, in the model that I constructed, the discounted cash flow model, you can see the uptick in the NPV with that, you know, cash flow at the beginning of the mine life. And, you know, that's, to me, is something that you really can make money on that speculation that it's going to improve the economics. And, you know, really mixed in with those other things, along with the tight share structure and good people, are all things that I think could lead to a good investment. So that's kind of like a spectrum of how I look at it. You know, it's, there's a lot more than just the price to value. There's all those kind of secondary inputs. But when you find that everything comes together into one investment thesis, I think that's where you can get strength.
Right. And let's delve into criteria a little bit more. I know you've mentioned some things like share structure and management. With respect to the company itself, what are, you know, and also the deposit that they may or may not have, what are some of the other things that you look for?
Insider buying is big, but there's a lot that goes into that. You need to know what the original positions are. Meeting is like, is it based out of founder shares, is what makes up their, you know, $1 million position, or have they been buying in the open market and are making significant enough buys that that it's a positive sign. You know, talking about the people, that's always been a big thing for me. And quite personally, when I'm going to be taking a position in, or a larger position in a company, I definitely want to have met the people. And there's kind of, I think over time I've learned that I am a good judge of people, and, I want to meet them and see what makes them tick, see how they treat other people. And, you know, that trust factor is a big, you know, qualitative part of the process for me, at least. I think also, you know, jurisdiction, if you're going to go into the riskier jurisdictions, the price to value, so that deposit or economic study, the company needs to be trading at a significant discount to the, you know, its intrinsic value. I think to counteract the risk, going into a certain place. And so if you can find, let's say, and fireweed is somewhat of a good example to a point. Jurisdictionally, they're in I would say, a good territory in Canada, and Canada in general is a pretty good place to invest when it comes to mining. And that can be another one of those aspects that, you know, tip the odds in your favor. Yeah, so those are a few of them.
Okay, you know, I have a follow-up question. This is somewhat, well, not that random, but because when we talk about jurisdiction, do you think that there are a lot of mediocre companies that are just skating by because they're located in a good, you know, or they're located in one of the best jurisdictions, and that's kind of what they talk about?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like, I think the VAT, okay, for, I'll say it like this, the 80-20 rule, or Pareto's law, is very real. And that breaks down to just about anything. And I 100% would say that, yeah, there's a lot of mediocrity in the business in general. And then probably even more so when you start getting into the good jurisdictions, whether it be Nevada in the States, or let's say Quebec in Canada. You know, there's a lot of mediocrity, and they can garner attention because of that jurisdiction. You know, it's sort of an easy sell. And this is, for me, again, this comes to like one of those things where if it's really easy to understand, probably everybody else gets it too. You know, it's probably going to require some deeper thinking to get an advantage, or maybe see the value in a company that others don't see. So, you know, I think there needs to be distinction between that first level stuff and second level stuff. And typically, you know, things are complex, and they do need some more depth in thinking for you to have an advantage over the crowd.
Yeah, and just along those lines, I mean, another tough question, but how can we distinguish between something that really has potential in one of these really good jurisdictions versus something that, you know, this is just kind of mediocre, this is a mediocre company and they're just kind of skating along because it's they're in a really good jurisdiction? I mean, I know we've mentioned some criteria, but do you have any additional thoughts on that?
Well, that is the question. But you know what I tend to do, because I try to remain kind of constant in my way of doing things, I try to stick to the best of the best. And you can look at grade. You can say, well, you know, grade isn't everything. Absolutely. You know, it ultimately comes down to economics. But you want to, if you start getting into these, you know, different metals, base metals, I think a big thing is cash cost. You know, if you can form an opinion on what the cash cost of this deposit, if it were in production, is going to be, you stick to that tier one type of deposits that are going to give you that, you know, grade, size. Size is a big one that I'm not sure that everyone's really thought about. But if you think about how hard it is to try to predict where a metal price is going, and then you look at these base metal deposits, really, when you got these little, even though they could be high grade, but you've got, let's say, a 10-year mine life or less, the senior company or whoever's going to buy that or put it into production really has to guess right in terms of where that's going to come into production, because it's very easy to, you know, you buy the deposit, you start building it, and then 3 or 4 years later, let's say the zinc price goes from $1.50 to $1. And the economics, or what made that, you know, a great investment to begin with, now is not going to make you any money. So if you've got a 20-year, 30-year mine life, it's much easier to be right in terms of a senior company buying you than it is for these smaller mine lives. And it's not to say that, you know, that the smaller mine lives can't work. They can. But that might, again, be another one of those things that kind of separate the best companies and the mediocre ones.
Right. So it sounds to me like your real advantage here is you have an engineering background, so you're able to look at what's going on with these companies and forecast some numbers, put them in a spreadsheet, and that can give you an idea of the potential economics. I mean, many people in the sector, we can do that, but we don't have the engineering background and that kind of expertise that you have. Is that really where your advantage is?
I don't know. Like I put a lot of work into understanding the upside and the downside. And I think in some ways it's pretty straightforward in terms of the investment thesis to kind of put that together. Yeah, I don't know. Like the times that I've made money I've had more courage than the rest of people. So when the thesis is most evident, everybody gets it and everybody's in, and that's like the prototypical bull market. When, you know, things are crap and it's not clear where things are headed, if you can still have your head about you and establish that investment thesis, that's where you have an advantage, because you're buying stuff that's on sale and, you know, people just don't care or can't see the potential. So if I were to say there's an advantage, the biggest advantage I've had is to have courage when everybody's fearful, and the other side, not necessarily fearful when everybody else is greedy, but to take profits when they're there. You know, the whole premise, you know, the 10 bagger premise is great. But you know, nothing goes straight up, and there's a lot of downside risk in junior mining stocks. So when there's profit there, you know, 30% profit is excellent. 100% profit is excellent. So I think people need to take money off the table continuously and always be willing to see the negative side of your investment thesis, because none of us get it all right.
Right. That's why I say trimming is important. You have to trim your big winners along the way. But with that being said, this is the 10 bagger podcast. So we are looking for 10 baggers. You know, before we close here, Brian, is there any chance? I mean, I didn't clear this with you before we started, but any chance you could share a company you think has 10 bagger potential?
Absolutely. And it's actually my largest position at the moment. So there's definitely some bias. But I think O3 Mining, ticker symbol is OIII, has the best price to value proposition, you know, in the junior market right now. And they've got a management team that, you know, has a history of success. Last week, they put their money where their mouth is and made another huge insider buy. And are located in, you know, a world famous jurisdiction of, you know, the Abitibi Greenstone Belt. And, you know, they've got the cash to move the company forward. So I think this one checks all the boxes. And that's why I have made it my number one position. But that's something that people may want to check out.
Awesome. Well, on that note, Brian, before we close, can you please tell us about Junior Stock Review? And I know that you're just transitioned to making it a paid newsletter. So tell our listeners where they can go to find your work and how they can subscribe.
Sure. Yeah. So I'll be launching the Junior Stock Review Premium next week. But if you become a free subscriber now, you'll save when that launches. You go to juniorstockreview.com and you'll see in the header, there's a place for you to enter your email address. And when everything's ready to rock, I'll send out an email and there'll be a coupon code that you can use to save on that premium letter if you're interested. Otherwise, I will be publishing free content still in the future, but of course it will be less than what it used to be. And, you know, thank you for that plug.
My pleasure. Well, thank you so much, Brian, for coming on. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to having you back in the future. We can talk more about 10 baggers.
Thanks for having me, Jordan.
Thank you for listening to the 10 Bagger Podcast, presented by the Daily Gold. For premium coverage of precious metals and the best junior mining companies, visit thedailygold.com/premium.